Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. We now come to the fourth non-governmental body. There was a very famous case when I was a student a long time ago called a Lawless case, European Court of Human Rights. And this is a question of what does a state mean when the declaration of emergency and particularly detention on a trial? And the European Court of Human Rights first case said the state is quite different from the individual. There must be a margin of tolerance in favor of the state. So margin of tolerance we exercise in relation to the Open Democracy Advice Center, technically doesn't come within our term of reference. Because we're looking at Chapter 9 bodies and their work. The submission from the Open Democracy Advice Center deals with the question of the access to information legislation. But we use the margin of tolerance in your favor. Now, so under the same rules as we had earlier today, invite the Open Democracy Advice Center. And for those of us who are not aware of your work, could you tell us what this advice center is and what it does, briefly? You have an additional minute, the 15 minutes. And who funds you and how do you operate? Thank you. I have the names here. Alison Tilly, Mukalani Dimba, Farabati Tata, Nicholas Hansler. That's the mosaic of South Africa.
Honourable Chairperson, as you've indicated, we are representing the Open Democracy Advice Centre. We're a non-governmental organisation that seeks to promote the open and transparent democracy through promotion of the Access to Information Act, the Protective Disclosures Act, and the Administrative Justice Act. What we want to consider in this submission is the mandate of the Human Rights Commission in relation to the implementation of the Right to Information and the Promotion of Access to Information Act. We believe access to information is a very powerful tool for development. We believe it's a powerful tool for transformation and for supporting participative governance. We think it's key to creating transparency and openness in government, and we've asked your staff to circulate some of our documentation in which we try to prove that access to information is a tool for supporting the implementation of social and economic rights. We believe that this right is a very important one. We believe it should be a living right and a reality for our people. Let me hand over to my colleague who will look more deeply into the role of the Human Rights Commission in this regard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Promotion of Access to Information Act accords certain responsibilities and obligations on the Human Rights Commission. And some of these I will just briefly touch on, as we think that they are quite important in this discussion about the roles and responsibilities of the Human Rights Commission. Firstly, the South African Human Rights Commission is required to design educational programs and public awareness campaigns on the right of access to information, especially in disadvantaged communities. Secondly, it is their responsibility to make recommendations to public institutions as well as private institutions on how to comply with administrative requirements of contained within this act. Then thirdly, they are to collect reports from public institutions on how the right of access to information is exercised and how the act itself is implemented. But most importantly, their responsibility to report to the National Assembly on the state of the exercise of the right of access to information in the country. And lastly, to advise and assist any other person who wishes to exercise their rights in terms of this act. What is a glaring omission in the mandate of the South African Human Rights Commission with respect to this law is the fact that there isn't an express statement that the South African Human Rights Commission has a responsibility to intervene in disputes between a requester of the information and the holder of the information. And secondly, there isn't a provision made for the Human Rights Commission to monitor and address substantive compliance issues with regards to this law. Now, it is our position that the responsibilities accorded to the Human Rights Commission in terms of this act are quite appropriate, but we believe that they are not comprehensive enough and they are not deep enough in improving the quality of decision-making with regards to this legislation. Most importantly, we argue that the key to successful implementation of this act is developing capacity, whether within the Human Rights Commission or outside the Human Rights Commission, for making determinations on whether or not records must be released. Now, after 5 years of this act having come into force, we have identified four key challenges in its implementation. The first one relates, obviously, to the issue of reporting by public bodies. I'll be honest with this committee and say that public bodies are not reporting adequately to the South African Human Rights Commission on the implementation of this legislation. And therefore, the Commission itself is not in a position of reporting to Parliament on the exercise of this right in general. In the last reporting period, out of 800 public institutions, only 46 actually reported to the Human Rights Commission on the implementation of the Act. The second issue relates to the usage of the Act by excluded groups. By excluded groups, we mean people who are not part of the mainstream of society purely because of either educational levels, their economic standing, or even disability. We did a survey 3 years ago where we tested the responsiveness of public institutions when they are approached by members of excluded groups for information. And 70% of the requests from these groups could not be submitted. And it was the conclusion of our study that the Access to Information Act remains inaccessible to excluded groups. The third challenge remains the challenge of mute refusals. By mute refusals, we mean those requests that are submitted but not responded to. Basically, these requests get ignored. In a 14-country comparative study that was conducted by the Open Society Institute, it was found that 62% of the requests to public institutions in South Africa are met with mute refusals. Basically, those requests are ignored. 62% of those requests were ignored. Now, this reflects a particular problem with implementation of this law, either because there isn't capacity within departments to deal with this law, there isn't a full understanding of the provisions of the law itself, and also it reflects a lack of guidance, a lack of leadership, external guidance and leadership that government departments can tap into. We do applaud the Human Rights Commission for the work that they have done to encourage institutions to comply with the administrative provisions of this Act. However, we believe that bolder steps are required to ensure that there is more extensive compliance with all provisions of this legislation, not just the administrative requirements of changing out manuals annually, but there needs to be deeper monitoring of how departments actually deal with requests for information. And we haven't seen any of that being done currently by the Human Rights Commission. The fourth challenge relates to an alternative dispute resolution mechanism in terms of this Act. Alison will address the committee a bit deeper and broadly on the issue of our submission in this regard. However, we do believe that there is an urgent need for an adjudicated system, our adjudication system, that will be much more accessible, much more cheaper to use, and much more easier to be relied on by both the requesters and the holders of the information. And we call on this committee to investigate whether such a function will be better placed within the Human Rights Commission itself, or whether an independent structure such as an information commission is required.
At the moment, the high courts are the only mechanism for enforcing a citizen's right to information. So even where the release of the record is clearly going to be the only possible lawful decision, public bodies have gone to court arguing that they need to retain the information. This is not confined to one particular department. It's across departments. It includes parastatals, both at national government level and provincial government level. In the 7 reported cases that have come before our courts involving public bodies, all of those public bodies have been ordered to release the information. In other words, requesters 7 and the state 0. The latest case to come before the Supreme Court of Appeal, Judge Combrink said that one of the objects of this legislation is to avoid litigation. But however, this was the 4th case in which information has been sought in the past 18 months, which has required the attention of the court, in this case the Supreme Court of Appeal. The present appeal, in this case against FAA, illustrates how it disregarded the aims of the Act, and the absence of common sense and reasonableness has resulted in this court having to deal with a matter which should never have required litigation. We've recently had a visit from Emily O'Reilly, who is the Information Commissioner for Ireland. In a speech she made, she said one generally has to have an adjudicator in FRI matters. Going to court is not a practical proposition. Ordinary people who want to use FRI to know what's going on in government do not generally have the resources or the skills to make court appeals. We don't know what the cost is to the state of litigating these cases. We did ask the state law advisor what the cost was, but we were refused that information. We believe that the money that is used to fight these cases and the resources that are used could be used more effectively in creating an independent enforcement body. There is a lot of consensus around the need for an independent enforcement body amongst different structures and institutions. The mandate of the Human Rights Commission, as it stands, is a necessary but not sufficient condition for the right of access to information to be realized. There are different options. The mandate of the Human Rights Commission could be increased. This has drawbacks. The Commission's role is to advocate for the right to access to information. It may not be in a position to adjudicate as well. Certainly in terms of overstretch, the Human Rights Commission are not managing to get public bodies to produce Section 32 reports. Now, if they're not managing that, how will they then take on an increased mandate around making decisions? It's something that would involve particular expertise. Is that expertise in the Commission? Obviously, it could be brought in. We favour the model of an independent commission. We draw attention of the committee to the approaching legislation around data protection. That legislation is probably going to propose a data protection agency and might well suggest that there is room for that agency to take on implementation of access to information as well. So you'd have one body, which is a model that is followed in a number of countries which have recently introduced access to information. We are arguing that the mandate of the Human Rights Commission as it stands is not sufficient. They concede in their own reports that they have not and cannot meet the task of ensuring that the right to information is respected, protected, promoted, and fulfilled. We believe an independent enforcement body is the key to ensuring access to information. We have brought with us copies of the Access to Information Act, its regulations, and a copy of the Protective Disclosures Act, and we'd be very happy to give copies of these to the committee. I don't think it will assist you with our submission, but simply in order to assist you with consultation on the issues that arise from the Act. Thank you very much.
The margin of tolerance is worse. But of course, I'll have to ask you, as is Professor, to the 15 minutes up, by the way. But you'll have a chance to answer the question. You come to a conclusion very early on that the Human Rights Commission is not the right body. You've given philosophical arguments, which we want to look into now, as to whether an investigative body can order. Have you raised these matters, the Human Rights Commission? That's the first question. Secondly, most of the information here provided in the report is 2001, 2002, 2003. Well, it's 3 years since then. And then you say on page 18, Commission tasks promoting likely effects of dissemination, actually information by the body about the activities. In a snap survey conducted by you, well, I don't know how snap it is, what year it is, 60% of public officials fail to respond to requests for information to the Act. Now, we are going to look at this issue of access to information. But we're going to do so on some rational, reasonable grounds. We can't say that, in fact, it hasn't worked because ODAC carried out a snap survey sometime or other, covering some grounds. The third point is that we accept it so easily, the State Attorney's Office, that they won't give you the cost of the action. When public funds are involved, there's no client-lawyer relationship. Nearly every country I know in Ireland, every year, they say, what's the earnings of advocates in the High Court? Every year they do that. And they tell you department by department how they are paid. But I'm surprised that you take it lying down that that this is... you see, the exemptions in the Act are very clear. What you don't mention here about the administration, in some of the countries, the exemptions are much wider than South Africa's. The United Kingdom is a classic example. Their notion of state security, as determined by the Secretary of State, is enormous. That's the third point. The fourth one is that because we have to look at, we refer to models elsewhere, and then we refer to federal systems, which include Japan and the United Kingdom. Well, neither of them is a federal system. It has a very profound importance now. Neither Japan nor the United Kingdom is federal. They're unitary states now. They're unitary states. Even allowing for Scotland and Wales, which are not covered yet by England. So, how do you extrapolate countries that have a particular philosophical position? The context, as the DAFA document, which we'll look at next, says the context is everything. History and context. In the South African situation, which I'll put to you as a fourth question, there is considerable impatience with the proliferation of new organizations. I can tell you there will not be a data protection agency. I can tell you that. You start, better start working on some alternative method than a data protection agency. There's a proliferation of agencies. I mentioned that there are 29 bodies set up directly and indirectly by Parliament. Until the researchers established that, I don't think anybody knew in South Africa, but Parliament established 29 bodies. Problems personnel. Of course, SADC doesn't want to pay market related. They despise market related salaries. They're not here, unfortunately. That's a very important point. If you're going to have agencies this time, right, you're going to pay market-related salaries. The state will not buy another institution. And I will refer you to Bob Heppel's professor, or Sir Bob Heppel's extraordinary study on the English equality bodies. It's irresistible. They said too many organizations in one area have just caused confusion, lack of support and remedy. So, can I ask you to be less rigid and say, the Human Rights Commission may be the instrument for this, right? So the first question was, have you discussed this matter with the Human Rights Agency, Human Rights Commission, and whether in fact they have agreed that they have neither the capacity nor the inclination to do more zealous work in this. The issue then is, you see, if this function is given to the Human Rights Commission, you don't need a specific legislation for that, because there will be an omnibus law changing presumably lots of terms of references. There will be an omnibus one. So there will be one line. But if you want a statute, and I can tell you, please, O'Kad, it's very hard to get government departments to prepare statutes. So these are matters to help your case, but we want responses so that we can take them to account. Five questions.
I will respond to some of those questions, Mr. Chair. Yes, the Human Rights Commission has been in discussions with role players in the field of freedom of information in the country. As regards to their attitude to...
Have you discussed these matters?
Yes,
with the Human Rights Commission directly.
Yes, we have directly. And there seems to be general agreement. When I say general agreement, I'm referring here to a conference that was called by the Human Rights Commission and involved members of parliament and government departments. And what came out of that conference was an agreement. Consensus was reached that really there is a gap in the law, and the law needs to be strengthened by having a mechanism, one way or the other, a mechanism that will be intermediary between making a request to the government department.
Well, and 2003, reporting proceedings of the Paia in Dhaka. Looks like a samosa, this Paia. Portuguese samosa. It says 2003, my dear brother.
Yes,
what happened since 2003?
These Paia in Dhabas are conducted on an annual basis. And in the last Paia in Dhaba that we had, there wasn't any resolution to change the decision that was made at the first Paia in Dhaba. So, as I'm saying, there is consensus on the issue. With regards to an introduction of a new agency dealing with these matters, I think we do raise this matter in our submission, where we say we are quite aware that this proposal for a new agency may run into counter-arguments that actually lesser organizations are needed than new ones. That's why we say having an information commission is the first prize, really. But if that cannot be the case, then we make other proposals, such as extending the mandate of the Human Rights Commission, but also strengthening the capacity of the Human Rights Commission to deal with this matter.
Thank you. If I can refer you to page 16 of the publication, we give a summary of the 2004 report of the Open Society Institute Justice Initiative Monitoring Study that was conducted across 14 countries. We were the continental coordinator and dealt with the African countries that participated. The countries involved: Argentina, Armenia, Bulgaria, Chile, France, Kenya, Ghana, Macedonia, Mexico, Nigeria, Peru, Romania, South Africa, and Spain. The full results have recently been posted to us by the Open Society Institute, in other words, the full research report, which we would certainly be happy to make available to the committee. This is probably the most recent information, and is information which has been used by the Office of the Public Service Commission in looking at their annual survey of the state of the public service. I think it is the most recent information that is available. Unfortunately, we don't have anything which has taken place in 2006 or 2007. We have no reason to believe that the results have changed. There has been no significant policy or structural institutional changes since the survey was done. As to taking the state attorney's refusal of information lines on, unfortunately we are simply too busy fighting other matters which we think are more important, perhaps more important in the sense that they are requests from poor people in communities who are not receiving basic services. Those requests and the results of those requests mean that people get water, they get access to electricity. Unfortunately, under those circumstances, we consider our interests what the price that the state pays is for fighting these requests is perhaps not something that we are going to litigate about, but it's certainly something that we are very interested in. We believe the cost of the litigation is very, very high, and that if there were some enforcement power somewhere, the cost of that enforcement power would certainly result in a cost savings in relation to litigation that has been entered into. The record of the state in this regard in refusing information is simply, it's really not very good. To look at the question of impatience with commissions and establishing new bodies, I think that there is obviously that issue, and the question as to whether one should or should not have the other commissions that have been established. You know, it is not an area of expertise that we have. What I would say, however, is that it is clear that if we want ordinary people to have access to information, they have to be able to go somewhere other than the High Court. If such an enforcement agency is not established, those people do not have the right to access to information. Putting it in the Constitution, putting legislation in place, is merely window dressing, because they can't get that information bottom line at the end of the day. And that is really what we are arguing for, is to make that right real. There must be some power somewhere where somebody can go and say, please, can I see my local government's budget? Can I see the IDP? Can I see what the plans are for bringing us water? These are very simple requests, and they are being currently refused, and people have nowhere to go.
You will, as I said, we have not concluded anything, but to assist us in our work and consist in the terms of reference, it will help us a great deal. If you could address this issue in a supplementary submission, but if the committee felt that there ought to be an instrument for enforcement, which would be the appropriate one? Now, on the basis that we can't invent new bodies, and what we say will not be without influence, put it this way, it will help if in fact we look at an existing structure. Now, I'll tell you, it's quite clear the Act is not working in terms of access to information. Replies, mute replies, or negative replies, is not working. It's not working in relation to the fact that if you ordinary people like me, I can't take case to court. I can't afford to, frankly. I'm a defendant, but I can't take case to court myself. So if I can't do that, you can imagine, you know, Alfred Zanini from Ingmar Vuma wants information about them, about why they're diverting the water from the Pongola River.
No hook.
No hook. Well, that's the point. Now, please, so I'm inviting you on behalf of the committee, but in fact we need an instrument for enforcement. The existing one is the Human Rights Commission. They have powers already. We don't accept this conceptual difference that if you're investigating a system, you can't be involved in enforcement. Legally, there's no reason why it shouldn't be that way. So you will help us. Now, you will not help us by putting charts as far as it has gone worse. I still read the replies under the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. I choose the countries. 180 countries ratified, I read about 25 of them. I still read the Convention on Racial Discrimination, the UN Convention, I read the replies. And South Africa doesn't do very well by the conventional replies. And lots of them are works of fiction. Other countries. And I'm telling you this. As a professor of law, I taught these subjects, and I used to tell the students, right, this is country X. This is what they say they're carrying out the Convention on Racial Discrimination. Would you like to analyze it as a project? It's a work of art, not work fiction. It's a work of art, many of them. So you mentioned some of the countries here, and as a chairman of this committee, I can't refer specifically to some of these countries. But I'm deeply skeptical about the response. You said in South Africa, your open society survey, you sent it down to 14 countries, 140 requests you made, which are fairly small, by the way, in other words, to come to extraordinary conclusions to. The case is not helped by comparison other countries, frankly. It's certainly not helped with me, because I know I was involved in minister about one rape every 5 seconds, and we realize where that came from in South Africa, right? Or with the murder capital of the world, we should try to go to Colombia, and 2 cities there in Colombia, I can find out which are the murder capital. So it doesn't help. What will help this committee is our conviction that legislative task, which is necessary in a democracy, is not being implemented or observed. Right? It's quite clear. What instrument can we use to make sure that the enforcement? We're inviting you. Right? And but we don't know. You see, point is, we haven't come to a conclusion. We'll come to a conclusion on the basis of the information given us. But as it stands, the idea that we can recommend another body in our report is one beyond our terms of reference. And secondly, I know, knocking around here, no one will accept a new agency being set up. You know that. You see, the civil servants agree with me. I'm only a mere politician. Detail.
Thank you. Whilst ODAC is contemplating the best instrument to be utilized, I would like to know, perhaps in respect of this particular legislation, the first question is, when you say that you would like to see the Human Rights Commission perhaps much better capacitated to deal with aspects of FAIR, are you looking internally, for instance, in terms of the unit that manages this particular legislation, the FAIR unit within the Human Rights Commission, being more expanded and being given much better resources? Or conceptually, what are you talking about? And perhaps the last question is, in terms of FAIR, it says here the information office of a public body may refuse to request for access, etc., to a record of that body if its disclosure would likely materially jeopardize the economic interests or financial welfare of the Republic. Now, do you overzealously pursue cases regardless of the merits or demerits in the context of what that particular section of the Act, or what exactly do you do? Because if you print the kind of stuff that Professor Osman has referred to, the chair has referred to, is it not possible that sometimes you are being a little overzealous in pursuing your case?
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you.
I'll take the first one regarding the capacity of the Human Rights Commission in dealing with this matter. The budget of the FAIR unit within the Human Rights Commission has not exceeded 150,000 rand per annum. That's excluding staff salaries. If you take those away, the resources that they have to run projects, last year alone, it did not exceed 100,000 rand. So there's obviously a lack of resources available to them to perform their mandate. The second issue is with regards to the powers that the Human Rights Commission has to deal with bodies that are not complying with the legislation. In the first few years of when the Act came into force, there was a requirement that institutions need to submit manuals to the Human Rights Commission. In the first 2 years, the Human Rights Commission didn't receive more than 50 manuals from public institutions, never mind the private sector. As I mentioned, the issue of reporting, the Section 32 reports, they are trickling in at not more than 100 per annum, while they're dealing with 800 public institutions. And the Commission has been reluctant to issue subpoenas, to issue orders that these reports be submitted to the Human Rights Commission so that they themselves can then report to the National Assembly. So you have two issues around, number one, the issue of resources. The second issue is the issue of the reluctance of the Commission to actually use powers that they have currently to meet their mandate.
Thank you. On the question of pursuing information, the way that we work is that we act as attorneys, we act as a law centre, and we act on behalf primarily of communities who are asking for information. Many of our cases don't in fact end up in court, because after we fought for 6 months or a year or 18 months, and by the time it gets to state law advisors or council, that local authority will be told, you must release this information, you have no basis to withhold it. So, ironically, we are rather frustrated about the number of cases that we can take to court, because although we have the capacity to do it, in many instances, the cases we are dealing with are so basic. It doesn't even get interesting. You know, it doesn't get to the point where we're dealing with national security or concerns around releasing trade secrets, for example. It tends to be about very basic documents that often other people at other levels of government assume are already public. So I don't think we could be described as overzealous. Zealous we are, but I don't think we're overzealous.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It has been very stimulating for us. I think it's worthwhile, really, to assist in this process. If the committee normally sends a statement out and will say that we are listening to this particular matter, and it was revealed to us, that will help in the debate. And as to the extent to which the legislation is not being observed, not being enforced, and in particular, it is put to us that, as the President has said, there must be machinery to resolve problems that citizens have without having recourse to courts. Right?
Yeah.
So if you'll sit down and draft a statement, we issue it, because I have to leave at 1 o'clock. So if you go out now and draft the statement and give it to them, I'll show it to the members of the committee. With a laptop or something like that. Okay. What's a laptop? I mean, somebody has laptops. The last one. Can you draft the statement, right? And put it in the word perfect form. Word perfect. Outside. Word perfect. I mean, word perfect grammatically, stylistically, and in terms of the impact you want to make. We agree, isn't that? That's very important. Thank you. It also gives you a day in court. Right, last one. Last one is... document. Thank you very much, and we have before us the relationship of the state institutions support the consumers by PIMS and the Institute for Democracy. Now we have the names of the four who are here, including someone whose name is very familiar to us. Yes, Judith Sudbury, Shabila Sadat, and Karen Handy. We have another Handy. The resurrection of Handy. We're extraordinary things. Thank you very much, Judith. You arrange for the presentation, and then we will look at the submission. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Honourable Chair, firstly, just to say we're very pleased to be here, and thank you for asking us to do an oral submission this morning. My comments will be introductory, and my colleague Shamila Sidas and Karen Handig will be dealing with the meat of the submission, as it were, and we'll all take questions. I think that what we've tried to do in this submission is really to focus on those general aspects of the institution supporting constitutional democracy, and also looking at the values that underpin the establishment and development of these bodies. I think that one of the things that you raised earlier about the context, I think we do try to indeed raise that, the context within which these institutions find themselves and operate. And I think by way of introduction, I'd like to just draw the committee's attention to the macro-social report released last year by the presidency entitled The Nation in the Making. And what that report found was that over half of it, they had a survey, I'm not sure if it was a snap survey, but it was a survey. The What that survey found was that half of the members who were, in fact, respondents had not heard of the Office of the Public Protector or the South African Human Rights Commission. And I think that that is, places us squarely in the realm of context. And so I think that if there's anything that this committee also grapples with, it's about what real people, whether they understand the workings of these Chapter 9 institutions and the way in which they are supposed to be, in fact, implementing rights and so on. So I think that if we can use that as sort of canvas or backdrop, it would be really helpful. Because we can sit here and talk about process and we can talk about rules and be very technocratic and legalistic, but we want to go beyond that. And I think that we try to make some recommendations. What we will try to do as well is we see our submission really at the start of an engagement with this committee. And that if there is supplementary research we can do, if there are other issues around you know, various things that we can add or subtract or tease out, we'll be perfectly happy to do that. But I think we want to focus on the issues of value. So I won't go on too much longer except to say that our paper is divided into three sections. My colleagues will deal with those values of independence and accountability and also issues of oversight, relationship with the legislature, and also issues of budgetary arrangements and appointment processes, as well as issues of accounting. So we are really very pleased to be here, and we hope that we can have a fruitful ongoing engagement with the committee on this very important issue. Thank you.
I was going to say, because the committee has discussed this, it may be necessary, because we have a comprehensive approach, for us to make a supplementary submission. But this is a very technical submission, really. And it only gives us three bodies, but it's very technical also. It may be in the light of our discussion earlier today, and the light of, we're going to spend a long time with the Human Rights Commission, not 3 hours. But it may be that you should be present without the right of audience when the Human Rights Commission comes here. And then make, on the basis of that, make a supplementary. So if we are fairly abrupt with you, because 15 minutes for a body that's talking about this may not be enough, it may be with the forbearance of the committee, we may invite you to make a supplementary. Thank you.
Good morning to the Honourable Chairperson, members of the committee. We thank you for the opportunity to address the committee today. The draft submission to the review committee focuses on the institutional design and parliamentary oversight over Chapter 9. Today we will be presenting a summary of our written submission and will address the committee on existing budgetary arrangements of Chapter 9, on aspects of the current appointment process for commissioners, on the absence of clear rules prohibiting commissioners from holding political posts while in office, and last but not least, on ways to improve the interaction between Parliament and Chapter 9 as they go about their complementary oversight roles. We consider these to be important areas for the following reasons. First, the design of an institution is generally seen to impact significantly on the independence and effectiveness of that institution. There is therefore a need to relook at issues such as budgets, appointments, and conditions of service, as already identified in the terms of this review. Second, we thought that a submission aimed at improving the quality of interaction between Chapter 9 and Parliament would be useful, as the track record of their interaction has not been ideal, and the relationship between Parliament and Chapter 9 is a fundamentally important one. Our first submission is on the budgetary arrangements for Chapter 9, and we begin by noting that the existing budgetary arrangements have been a subject of considerable debate. Two specific issues have been raised. First, are the budgets of Chapter 9 sufficient to enable them to carry out their mandate? And second, does the involvement of the executive branch of government in the budget process intrude upon the independence of these institutions? We do not address the first question in our submission and take the view that even if budgets are sufficient and resources adequate, the second question, namely who primarily influences the budget and what effect this has on independence, does need to be addressed. This is because financial autonomy forms part and parcel of the constitutional requirements of independence. Our submission in this regard looks specifically at the budgetary arrangements for the Human Rights Commission, the Gender Commission, and the Public Protector. Our first observation is that, under the current budgetary system, it is the executive through Treasury that plays the primary role in determining the budget. Conversely, Chapter 9 and Parliament play a much smaller role. While Chapter 9s do make an input on their projected budgetary needs, and while Parliament does engage in the budget process via the MTEF and via the Assembly vote, we point out that Parliament's ability to engage meaningfully has been limited to date. Parliamentary oversight over Chapter 9 budgets through mechanisms such as the MTEF is likely to improve over time, and this will go a way in asserting the independence of Chapter 9. However, one can go further and ask whether the current budget model is appropriate given the constitutional independence status of Chapter 9. In the new National Party case in 1999, Chief Justice Langer of the Constitutional Court clarified that financial...
We are aware of that. There's a whole page on that, so we're aware of that. Thank you.
Well, okay. What lies behind the approach of this case? We can take for granted that the executive's intention towards Chapter 9 are benign. However, it appears that the current arrangement does allow for the possibility of executive influence or pressure simply through the extensive involvement of the executive in the process. Under the current arrangement, Chapter 9s are dependent on budget allocations received through the executive and the very departments they are required to monitor, thereby posing a potential threat to their independence. It must be accepted that for Chapter 9s to discharge their mandate, they should feel confident that the conditions under which they work do guarantee their independence. In other words, the notion of institutional or functional independence. The current budgetary arrangements are an area of concern, and we take the view that Parliament, as the body to which Chapter 9s are accountable to, is appropriately positioned to primarily determine the budget of Chapter 9.
I think there's general agreement. I already announced this morning that Parliament will be. What you don't cover is exactly as I challenged Kostasu on. How do you arrange for it? So can we pass on then? Because we all agree that Parliament must decide the budget. The modalities are not very clear. Okay, let's move on then. Thank you.
As far as our recommendations are concerned, we emphasize that adjusting the current procedure would not mean that the executive ceases to play any role. This would clearly be inappropriate from a policy point of view. Although a number of alternatives exist, we submit that a favorable option may be to allow Chapter 9 to submit their medium-term budget proposals to the relevant portfolio committee. The respective committee could then engage with both these institutions and Treasury on the projected allocations and report to the House. Ideally, Chapter 9 budget should be separated from the Ministry, perhaps to form a separate vote. Added to this, we recommend that Parliament introduce legislation in terms of Section 77(3) of the Constitution to provide a procedure for Parliament to amend money rules as a matter of urgency.
You're having a practical session. The point is that the Justice Portfolio Committee, which accounts for most of these bodies, has 25, nearly 30, Ms. Johnson, bodies they report to. One of the complaints is that they only see the Human Rights Commission either when the budget comes up or when the annual report comes up. Now you're going to add a budget to the committee. Now, the Justice Committee, of course, is very strong way in the committee. They rewrite all the legislation in the context of the Constitution. But the other committee is not as strong as that. Can I ask Idrasa to rethink this? Again, it's been practical assistance to us. Can you not now rethink it? I'm just telling you now because we are having a proper exchange now between two sets of people. Professionals on one hand, suppliants on the other. Two sets, suppliants we are. Now, can you go away and think the portfolio committee may not be the appropriate one? And we're saying seriously, isn't that so? Right, yeah. May not be the appropriate body. But it may be the appropriate body. We don't know. But it will help us if you think of some other way. Thank you very much.
We'll do so, Honourable Chair. We also take the view that the review should consider an alternative procedure to the current appointment process for commissioners. It is evident that the legislative branch of government is primarily responsible for selecting and appointing commissioners, and that this does have a number of benefits. If the question we raise is whether the legislative branch plays too great a role in the selection and nomination process, and what impact this has on the capacity of Chapter 9 to act independently, In evaluating this, we begin with the premise that any appointment process should lead to the selection of suitably qualified and independently minded candidates, that the process should involve civil society and must be free from undue interference by political parties, governments, or other interest groups. At the outset, it must also be noted that the current appointment process does have many positive features. The recommendation process involves the public, the interview process is transparent, and legislation sets forth criteria and qualifications for appointments to attract competent and independent-minded candidates. Nevertheless, under the current process, appointments are ultimately made on the sole recommendation of politicians. There does appear, therefore, to be an inadequate set of checks and balances to prevent the unwarranted inclusion of politics in the appointment process. The procedure is also a not very inclusive one, taking place primarily in Parliament's court. Seen in this light, party political considerations could end up overshadowing more relevant criteria, such as expertise and qualifications. Certain organisations and scholars observing the process in practice have pointed to this. It must be prudent for this review committee to consider the establishment of an external panel to deal with the selection and nomination of commissioners to Chapter 9. The exact composition and role of the panel would still need to be determined by Parliament. In one possible scenario, the panel's involvement could be limited to compiling a short list of possible candidates, with interviews and selections still being done by the National Assembly and final approval by the President. In another scenario, the panel could be granted more substantial powers. The introduction of an independent panel is not a new idea and has in the past been canvassed by the Gender Commission. It is also worth noticing that the IEC Act does establish a separate panel to make recommendations on potential IEC commissioners. It could be prudent to add this extra layer of accountability to all Chapter 9 appointments. Altering the appointment process, of course, does not eliminate the involvement of the legislature, but is a viable policy choice open to the legislature, offering the advantage of a more inclusive, consultative, and independent process. Then turning to the question of political office, we submit that the review should address the need for a uniform and explicit prohibition on commissioners holding posts in political parties or even being members at all. The issue became a very practical concern in 2004 when members of the Gender Commission were on party lists and refused to resign.
We have that. The time is up. That's a problem. I'm giving extra time because of my intervention. Would you like to wrap up the submission?
Well, the rest of our presentation deals, the presentation is actually quite detailed, deals with Parliament's engagement with the ISEs and ISEs' engagement with Parliament. So it deals with the issues of reports, types of reports that ISEs can submit. It uses two examples, the Human Rights Commission and the AG. The point of those examples is that obviously didn't really have the capacity to look at all the Chapter 9s, although we would have liked to have done so. But we thought that those two organizations, in some respects, represent different, they're called different types of Chapter 9. We then look at the procedures for the tabling and referral of reports in Parliament, as well as the oversight practices of the various parliamentary committees. So the idea is to try and get a sense of, you know, there have been concerns that Parliament hasn't used ISE reports optimally, and there have also been concerns around the Section 1813, as well as Parliament's role in monitoring recommendations made to the executive. The last section of the report, and I'm being brief, deals with parliamentary oversight over the Chapter 9 themselves. And there we do, in fact, put forward some ideas about how Parliament could restructure its role. We look at the Justice Committee. We explore the idea of a dedicated ISC committee. And that, of course, relates to the issue of budgets. So if there was a dedicated committee, then that committee would be responsible for really looking at budgets. So that's a brief summary. Unfortunately, we ran out of time. Thank you.
You see, everybody wants to look at the sexy ones. Human Rights Commission, Public Protector, etc. Nobody wants to look at the other eight of them. This is part of the problem. We have to look at all 11. Secondly, yesterday I raised this issue in the ANC caucus. I thought there were 26 portfolio committees. No, there are 34 of them. If you had the standing committees, you talk about 45 of them. You see, yeah, but yeah, well, subcommittee is crazy. Now, because we're an ad hoc committee. Now, there's a very limited resources. Now, the ANC proposed about 2 or 3 years ago the size of the committee should be narrowed down smaller. Now, if you're making suggestions that there should be a special committee dealing with this, you're taking into account reality. Now, I know that sometimes you can buck reality, but reality is there. Second point, you see, this is a historical document about Rehe. If you cut down that no one should be involved in political life, should be a member of the commission, you are then renouncing the whole history of struggle in South Africa. This is something we discussed at Kodesha too. You're cutting away large numbers of people who've come through the struggle of the liberation of civics and all that, and whose membership is very important. Now, so most senior civil servants, my director general can belong to a political party, and the director general plays a very important policy role. So I think you'll reconsider this. But can I bring to your attention that because non-governmental organizations love to make comparisons with other countries, but as a former academic, I always realize, of course, that you can look at the reality of what happens rather than what the book says or a professor from Western Australia says. Let me tell you, in the United States, they're very clear. Every one of the Federal Trade Commission, Security Exchange Commission, is appointed on party political grounds. Now, these have enormous economic power. Well, not only the judges out. I mean, they are like Caesar's wife, above suspicion, because they're very old. Because they're very old, that's why. But let me tell you, apart from district judges, district justices and all, some of them, let me just tell you, in a democracy, openly, they say, the Human Rights Commission, change of president, there's a Human Rights Commission, believe it or not, there, out. The president appoints. And unfortunately, when Clinton is there, very different people get appointed. Now it's dead. The most important constitutional body in France, the Cour Constitutionnelle, the Constitutional Council, the party political appointments are made now. Remember, they don't have a judicial review of legislative action, but pre-legislation review they have. And I know some of them were appointed, by the way, by Mitterrand and others. I know them. It's a political appointment. So therefore, I'm not asking you to... We are dealing with this issue. But I think you're too dismissive about the nature of politics involved. The Human Rights Research Council, published in a January report, says, political activism ought not to be an automatic disqualifier for one to assume leadership, Chapter 9 institution. In any case, given the political nature of the subject itself, that's the important thing, it's highly unimaginable that any human rights activist, regardless of background, would be apolitical. Now, so the difference between being apolitical and party political. Now, I'm asking you to reconsider this. And particularly reconsider the idea that you can use the Independent Electoral Commission. You know, the Chief Justice can hardly turn up when there's a change of minister. He has to be there. To involve the Chief Justice, then you want to take away someone from the Human Rights Commission, and then you complain the Human Rights Commission not doing as well. It's an abstract approach, that you see. And what we want is, because we're looking at the point system, we're not asked that, right? We've got to make recommendations about it. But to take Parliament out of it, and then to make them, in a sense, and make them then accountable to Parliament, you have to reconsider this. But just think of the American situation, the French one, the Italian one, and then Mrs. Thatcher only appointed people when they answered the question, is he one of us? She never appointed women, by the way, 21st. So we're not going to that level of, is he one of us? But we've already looked at the question, and we will get a submission very soon for one of the portfolio committees about the appointment system. Right? So it comes from when the ANC portfolio committee comes from. Right? But I think that we have to be not abstract and unrealistic, but we can make one kind of appointment system. Already it varies greatly. Now, for us, for example, that the Communications Act changed the appointment system for ICASA. Now, I speak an individual. It fills me with great foreboding that the minister can appoint from a list submitted to Parliament. Right? That's not consistent with the independence. Other systems which are open and transparent, where the executive doesn't appoint, the Parliament does. However messy it may be, that's the point. And I must tell you, everything we do in Parliament by nature is messy. It works. But it's messy by nature because there are so many people involved in it. Right? So therefore I'll ask you to reconsider some of this in a broader submission you make to the committee, isn't it, sir? In a broader one. Members of the committee?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I listen to what you say, but I still think we should strongly bear in mind striving towards independence.
All I'm saying is there are factors that should be taken upon which still result in an independent body. Yeah, of course. But we may need a re-look at that. Next question. Yes, the chairman.
Yes, Chairperson, the suggest on the one hand that enactment of Section 77 sub 3 legislation will further enhance the role of Parliament as far as money laws are concerned. But on the other hand, they seem not to trust the sincerity of the very institution in dealing with the appointments of the Chapter 9 institutions. And I think they want to enhance their countervailing power by clamoring for more involvement of civil society formations. I think in line with that particular section 193, is it 6 of the Constitution? What I do not understand is why is it that we seem to be doing this cherry picking when it suits us? Parliament will be more independent. And then that doesn't suit us. No, it won't be more. It won't be independent. So exactly what are you saying? And I just want to piggyback on Professor's question about the role of Parliament as an institution and its oversight role over the executive.
You're asking them to be consistent. That's not a fair question. That's totally unfair. But the chairman will allow it.
Well, far to be consistent. Well, the question of budget 77.3. The oversight is usually interpreted, well, cannot really be interpreted vis-a-vis the executive. So that's either parliamentary oversight over government. The appointments of Chapter 9, I mean, it must be that Parliament must be primarily responsible, if not solely responsible, for appointing commissioners. But that, I mean, the Constitution does say, as you pointed out, that civil society must be involved. But a civil society can be involved. The Constitution allows for all affairs of Parliament, all legislation as part of public participation is a part of that. So I think that's really what we're talking about. And in terms of appointments, that public participation, I think, should be structured. It's important to get, really important in terms of appointments, to get public participation because commissioners and so on, they need to have a profile. The communities need to know who they are and so on. So that engagement needs to, I think, be structured. I think that is really what the gist of our argument. But we're certainly not saying that Parliament shouldn't be involved in appointments. It shouldn't be almost responsible for recommending appointments.
Thank you. Any other questions?
No.
Thank you. Thank you. You see, we have high expectations. We want high expectations from some organs of civil society who take their job seriously. That's why I would say, would you like to reconsider this? Because this is not an artificial exercise. It's not a seminar where you score points, you know, in a university or all of those awful Oxford Union debates that take place, which the parochial South Africans think is enormously important, the Oxford Union. We have a product of one of the Oxford Union debates here. This is a genuine thing. And that insofar as the meeting of minds is concerned, it's all the better. Because one of the things we're going to recommend is something that Parliament could carry out, we hope, with enthusiasm. And that is why I like the presentation that bears out what we said earlier, a minimal amount of constitutional amendment, because it's very difficult, a minimal amount of legislative change, because you will rely on ministers to bring the legislation, right? Yeah. Minimal amount, possibly an omnibus bill that brings about the change, an omnibus bill, right? We edified by calling it, you know, institute supporting democracy amendment bill, right? An omnibus bill, where they can make all those changes. Now, it may not be possible, but what we want to do is to present to Parliament, and I don't very rarely use the word realistic, but in fact, proposals that can be acted on very quickly. And that is why I think that we need to take into account these other factors. And of course, we had the earlier session with your counterparts in the Freedom of Information, where we, in fact, we had an we linked with them about the necessity to ensure some kind of order, and particularly the implementation of the rights that exist. So we are already working on that. So in the meantime, thank you very much. We look forward to a more general, additional documentation from IDASA. But in the meantime, so I remind you that on Wednesday we have, I have a whole box of stuff, by the way, from the Independent Electoral Commission. It's all about voters' returns, you know. Anyone wants to have them, they can have them. And then next Friday, of course, we have the Gender Commission. There's a good deal of material to read on that. Thank you very much.
Before you go, just an administrative matter. The latest program shows that the Houses, the National Assembly at least, will not sit in the week of the 19th.
That's either what?
The week of the 19th of March. And I think we have two of our meetings scheduled for that.
No. We will adjust it. You see, what we can't change, Court Science, on the moment, is an appointment with a Chapter 9 body.
But what do we have those two?
No, we don't have an appointment with Chapter 9 body.
Therefore, we can say.
No, then we're going to meet for four times. Okay? We meet four times when we come back.
Yes. Yeah? Good job. We agree.
Is that okay? Well, I should be here, by the way. But be careful. On the 2023rd of the Appropriation Bill, isn't that so? In March. 20th of March. They're moving, sorry. Oh yes, there was a complaint yesterday, they're changing We complained the ANC, they're changing the diaries and all.
It's Sam Lowe.
Yeah.
It's Sam Lowe, blame him.
Well, the other reason also is that I think the reason because Human Rights Day on the 21st of March, it's imposing an awful burden on members of Parliament to come back on Thursday and Friday.
Exactly.
Oh, gee. Thank you. We'll make up for those 2 days.
So no objections agreed to?
Yeah, agreed to. Thank you. Well, I'm not thank you for anything. Thank you.